just read a couple of quotes in the reading. This is from my book, The World Peace Diet. There's a quote by Emerson that I really like that I'll start with here. He says this, very short, to the point. Let's see here, sorry. Okay. People wish to be settled. Only as far as they are unsettled is there any hope for them. Albert Einstein, let's see here, he says, a human being is a part of the whole, called by us the universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings, as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty. And finally, a short statement by Thich Nhat Hanh, the renowned Vietnamese Zen master. Every day, 40,000 children die in the world for lack of food. We, who overeat in the West, are feeding grains to animals to make meat. We are eating the flesh of these children. So, good morning. It's great to be with you. I'm honored to be here with you and to be able to talk about ethical eating. I actually was at the 2008 GA when this was chosen as the topic of study. I was flown in and gave a talk on ethical eating, actually. And I really honor the denomination for taking this on, because personally, I don't think there's anything more important we can talk about than this. And so I just want to thank all of you and really thank the denomination for taking this on. And I myself, just to give you a little background, really was born and raised in a family that ate the usual food. You know, I was born and raised in Concord, Massachusetts, which was actually kind of neat because I was born in Emerson Hospital. I learned how to swim in Walden Pond. I went to Thoreau School and Alcott School, and transcendentalism just oozed out of everything there. And so it was really a wonderful place to grow up in that sense. And I always love to reminisce, and I did quite a bit of research when I got to college on the transcendentalists and how Thoreau had the largest library in the whole United States back in the 1840s of books from Asia, books on Taoism, Buddhism, Vedanta, and Hinduism and so forth. And so they were really starting to look at humanity's heritage of compassion and wisdom from a more broad point of view. In fact, Alcott, right outside Concord, started the first, I guess what you would say today, actually, the word wasn't invented until 1944, was the first vegan community. I remember going there not too long ago and seeing how they lived, and he got some money from Emerson to buy this land and set this community up called Fruitlands, and they wouldn't eat any meat, dairy, or eggs, or wear any leather. They wouldn't wear any cotton, because in the 1840s, where did cotton come from? Slavery. So there they were, walking through the snowdrifts of Concord in January in shoes made out of linen. So these are hardcore vegans. But anyway, none of that, I didn't know anything about that growing up. And I remember at one point I asked my mother, Mom, the kind of food we're eating, is this what everybody eats? And my mother said, yes, this is what everybody eats. And I said, in the whole world? She said, yep, in the whole world, this is what everybody eats. And I said, okay. And then she came back a minute later. She said, well, there are vegetarians. And she said it in a way that made me sure that these vegetarians must live on another planet. You know, they're hypothetical people. They don't really exist in this country because where would they get their protein? You know, so they just never met one. And it's true. I went through my entire life growing up never hearing another word about it. And nothing was ever talked about. I remember going away when I was about 13 to this beautiful organic dairy in Vermont, where the kind of dairy where nothing bad could ever happen. And it's all, you know, small, local, and I participated in the killing of chickens, and I participated in the killing of the cows when they didn't give enough milk anymore. And it was shocking for me as a kid to participate in that, to stab and see the blood flowing and shooting and all these kinds of things. But I never doubted that it was the right thing to do. I knew it was right because I knew, beyond the shadow of a doubt, because I had been indoctrinated into a culture from the time I was born that told me that animals are put here for us to eat, they don't have a soul, they taste good, and if you don't eat them, you will die of a protein deficiency. So that's it. It's either them or us. And so I never questioned the rightness of it, even when I saw how much they resisted, how they did not want to be killed, how they yearned for their babies who were stolen from them for milk. I just thought this is the way it's supposed to be. And I went away to college, and I kept thinking that. And I think on some level I was beginning to question things, but I heard there were some vegetarians somewhere on the campus, but I never actually met one. And this was in Colby College in Maine in the early 70s. But I did hear a fellow come and talk to us about the Vietnam War, and he told us about how when people fly over South Vietnam or North Vietnam and drop bombs, that these bombs would explode, but they were so far away and so high up, and they'd fly back, and basically it didn't bother them because they didn't see what happened. You know, they weren't down there seeing people screaming and everything, the blood and all that. They were far away, and the general who gave the order was even more removed. And I remember feeling very outraged at this idea that we can be so removed from the results of our actions, that we can place an order, and somewhere because of that order, there will be terror and pain and blood and horror. But I don't feel anything because I don't see it. I'm not participating. So I was outraged by that, but I didn't ever make the connection to anything about food. And then I remember a little later, I found a book. Some of you may have heard of this. It's called Cosmic Consciousness, a book by a guy named Richard Buck. He wrote it in 1890. He said basically this. He said, most people in our planet attain what he called self-consciousness. That's where we're at. We're self-conscious. We care about ourselves, right? Maybe a little group around us, but basically that's it. He said, but there are certain people historically who have attained a higher level of consciousness. He said these great, the founders of religions, the Buddha, Jesus, Muhammad, Paul, some great sages and saints and writers, Dante and so forth. He said these people had a much higher level of consciousness, and they lost a lot of the fears and pettiness that most of us have. And I remember reading this and getting very excited, enthusiastic, and thinking, that's it. I want to attain cosmic consciousness. And I remember telling my parents about this, and they were like, we're paying you all this money to go to college, and you want to attain cosmic consciousness? But this was back, in the mid-70s, and I told my brother, 2 years younger than me, Ed, and I told him about it, and he said, yeah, let's do it. Let's just do it. So we get some books on Eastern philosophy. I remember reading the Bible, what Jesus said, and I said, it was all pointing right in that direction, that there is this kingdom of heaven, there is this higher consciousness, and when we attain that, we have greater compassion and wisdom and joy, and we live in a whole different way. And so we thought, well, how do we actually do this? How do we attain it? We need a plan. So we thought about it, and we made a plan, and the plan was this. We knew this would work. We will go to California. That's where the cosmic consciousness is. It's in California. 1975, San Francisco, here we come. So we took off. We headed down the driveway. I remember I had my little backpack with a spare pair of pants and some fresh baked cookies from my mother, and we were heading off to find cosmic consciousness, and we worked our way west. We went for a few months, maybe about a month and a half, and walking, a little hitchhiking, walking, meditating, working on our inner practice, and we got finally to Buffalo. And Here it was getting cold, it was frost at night, it was in October, it was Buffalo, and I thought, okay, now I have a bachelor's degree from a good school, it's October, you're in Buffalo, I can figure this out, we better head south. So we turned left, and we just walked south, and we walked about 20 miles a day, 15 to 20 miles a day, every day. We had nothing, we had no money, we had no, I mean, we had a little extra clothing, but we gave it away, because if you have to carry it, pretty soon you don't really need it. And we walked our way down through upstate New York, Pennsylvania, West Virginia. They told us, now, boys, you're in the Bible Belt. I didn't know what that meant, actually, being from New England, but I found out that they tried to save us every night. It was quite an experience. But we kept going and meditating, and we got into eastern Kentucky and then eventually to Tennessee. And by the end of the year, we had arrived at a place called The Farm. And in 1975, The Farm was the largest hippie commune in the world, almost 1,000 people, and they were all from California. So there we were. We met them in the middle. And when I got there, I realized that I was in a community of people who were eating a completely plant-based diet. 1,000 people. Nobody used the word vegan back then because no one knew it, but that's really what they were doing. They were doing it out of compassion for animals and for starving people. Francis Morlepe had written a book called Diet for a Small Planet, which talked about how wasteful it is to eat grain, eat meat when you can feed that grain to people. And so they were really making an effort to create a model for sustainability and kindness and spirituality and so forth. And I saw it with my own eyes. They were not dying of a protein deficiency. You know, they were actually, there was kids, about 100 children. A lot of them were vegan from birth, and they were healthy, strong, and happy. So that was it. I never ate meat again. From 1975 on, it was very obvious. It was sort of a combination of seeing that you could make, you could make food. It took me, a week or two to get used to the food, a lot more grains and beans and vegetables and things. Where's the meat, But I realized that I felt better and better, actually. And I asked them, why are you doing this? And they told me some of the things that went on. I think I knew this in the back of my mind. I knew, they told me how chickens are hyper-confined in these battery cages and how they chop their beaks off and how they castrate all animals without anesthesia and they steal the babies and this whole just unbelievable violence towards billions of animals. And that was it. I was like, I'm not going to do that anymore. Forget it, So I understood that. And then I ended up, believe it or not, a few months later, we left and we ended up at a Zen center in Alabama. You probably think I'm lying, but it's true. There was a Zen center in Alabama in the Korean tradition. Eventually, a couple of years later, I got out here, came to San Francisco, lived in a Tibetan Buddhist center here, and then I decided to become a Zen monk. So I went to Korea and found myself for the second time in my life in a completely, actually, vegan community, a community of people that ate no meat, dairy, eggs, wouldn't wear leather, wouldn't wear silk, just wouldn't even kill mosquitoes, basically. You tried to sort of take them. It would be so gauche to just kill things, And the idea was to, in this monastery, was we're really meditating. We would sit in silence. I took a vow of silence for 3 months, and we sat in meditation from 3 o'clock in the morning till 9 o'clock at night, that was it, just sitting. And so I had already, was already sitting in silence every day for hours, but this was really, a lot more. And I felt like through this process of being in this monastery that had been vegan for 650 years, so it wasn't just a new California idea, it was an ancient wisdom tradition. I understood that if you're really serious about cultivating a mind of compassion and clarity, it will not work to commit violence toward other beings, that violence always creates suffering and always creates bondage for oneself and for others. So when I eventually came back to this country, I felt like I had these roots that went just deep into my soul or heart. And it was really difficult. I got my PhD at Berkeley, taught college for a number of years. And then I started seeing there's much more to this, what we're doing to animals for food routinely. We're killing 75 million animals every single day in the United States for food. This is a gigantic operation. If anyone came from outer space and said, well, what are they doing down there? That's what they would, they'd probably, radio back up to the mothership and say, well, they're just killing a lot of animals for food. We live in a solar-powered RV for the last 15 years, my wife and I. We left Healdsburg, actually, 15 years ago, and what we see is vast monocultures of corn and soybeans covering North America, and it's not fed to humans. If we were feeding it to humans, we could feed not only everyone in the United States, we could feed everyone in China with what we're growing in the United States, but we feed it to animals, and then those animals we eat, and so there's an enormous amount of sickness, disease, violence, pollution, and so forth caused by this system. And so I started to see this, and I remember telling my wife, Madeline, you know, someone is going to write a book that will give the big picture of our routine mistreatment of animals for food, because people have written books, actually, that it's bad for your health, and it's bad for the animals, a lot of cruelty, it's bad for the environment. We all know that, basically. But I saw it's way, way, way bigger than that. What is the history of it? The anthropology, the sociology, the psychology, the spirituality. How does our violence, our routine violence towards animals for food, boomerang? How is it so well covered up? How does it affect us? You know, we who are just, in a sense, forced into it from birth, into a system, from every institution in our culture that basically forces us into a mentality of disconnectedness and of exclusion. We want to be inclusive, but it's a mentality of exclusion when we kill, confine, and harm animals for food. It's a mentality of privilege and elitism. It's a mentality of the domination of the feminine. It's female animals, by far, that are most severely brutalized in this whole thing. So when I started to look deeply, I saw that our feminine wisdom is at the heart of what's being violated by eating animals for food. So I said to Madeline, you know, someone's going to write a book about this. I can't wait to read it, you know. And so years went by. I said, yep, I'm sure it's going to come out soon, this book. And finally, Madeline said to me, well, I think if you want to read that book, you will have to write it yourself. So I spent 5 years writing The World Peace Diet, and it came out, and we've been traveling since then for the last about 4.5 years speaking. And amazingly enough, it has really begun to create a lot of momentum. And in March, The World Peace Diet went all the way to number one on Amazon. I remember I was so glad when Karl Rove's book was at number 5. And when I hit number 4, it was like, yes, we can beat Karl Rove and we can go farther. So there's, and I think the reason it went to number one is that this book hits a chord deeply in people, because all of us have been forced into behavior that is not in our best interests. And the amazing amount of violence towards animals for food boomerangs in incredible ways that are fascinating to look at. So The World Peace Diet has come out as an audiobook. It's 13 and a half hours long. That's really how long it takes to give this whole message. And I'm out of time now. So I'd like to just encourage you to come back this afternoon at 1:30, or is it 12:30? Excuse me, 12:30. And I will lay this whole thing out. It's the most empowering, most liberating action I think anyone can take, is to understand food. Every anthropologist knows if you want to understand a culture, you understand the food. If you want to understand the main way that any culture transmits its morals and values from one generation to the next, it's food. It's a taboo in this culture to talk about food, to talk about this, because we don't really want to know about ourselves. And just remember, at the top of the temple in Greece, there was a saying, gnathi souton, which means know thyself. We will never know ourselves unless we understand the culture that we've been born into, and that basically in whose language we think and whose images and stories we tell ourselves and that are constantly told to us. We have to understand those stories, and then we can connect with our inner wisdom. And we can begin to transform our own life, and we can be part of a positive evolution of consciousness on this planet. We are part of that. We have to understand the roots, the spinning fury at the core of this culture, then we'll have the power. So I just want to close by thanking all of you for the efforts you're making. I know if you're in this room, you've already started questioning a lot of the stories of this culture, that are the stories of domination and exploitation. This is the key to all of them. And it's the one that people really don't want to look. But when you do, it's a fantastic liberation. So I, again, want to thank all of you and bless you on your path. And just join together with you, knowing that we are part of a beautiful celebration of life on this earth. And when we are mature, when we are truly mature intellectually and spiritually and emotionally and ethically, then we will create the kind of world that we truly deserve to live in. Until that time, we have a lot to learn. So question everything. Question everything. Krishnamurti said, it is not a good idea to be well-adjusted to a sick society. We all want to fit in, but this is something where it's better to question. Bless you all. Much love. Thank you. Thank you. What happens now? I go over here. No? Okay.
Let's raise our body and our voices in song and sing hymn number 203, All Creatures of the Earth and Sky.